Pip Courtney is the presenter of Landline on ABC TV. Pip seems to have come into the world fully formed, with her character and purpose ready to go. The Pip of today doesn't seem a world away from the child that she was, a tiny, fiery girl who loved horses and who read The New Yorker because she wanted to be a journo when she grew up, just like her dad. Pip's been working for the ABC since she graduated from uni, first in her home state of Tasmania, and then reporting on Landline. Pip is a much-loved figure in country Australia, and so thousands of people rallied around to sustain her when her husband, John Bean, lost his life in a helicopter crash back in 2011, along with Paul Lockyer and Gary Ticehurst, while they were filming for the ABC at Lake Eyre. A few months later, Pip took on the demanding role of Landline presenter. And she said that having to wake up each day to tackle something so scary was a way of not disappearing into her intense grief. Pip's story is amazing, but because she is a trained journo who doesn't think she should really be talking about herself, I have to tell you, Pam and I have had to staple gun her to her chair and ply her with a six-pack of cola. Hello, Pip.
Hello, Richard.
How old were you, do you think, when you decided to be a journalist?
In primary school, when people would say, what are you going to do when you grow up? I always thought it was a stupid question. You just don't know. But I just saw my dad loving his work, and he was a workaholic and he worked night shift, and I didn't get to see much of him. Neither my brother or sister or I got to see much of him when we were little, and I just wanted to be closer to him, and I wanted to do what he did, and I just loved the way that he loved going to work every day, and even on holidays he was still working. I just thought, I just want that.
I think a lot of journos I speak to want to become journos as kids because they see it as like a passport to worldliness in a way. Like you grow up in some little place and you know there's a much bigger world out there. But journalism might be the ticket that takes you to the big world. Is that like, was it like that for you too?
I think so. The house was always full of interesting people. Also, Dad, I grew up badgering Dad for more stories about when he worked at the Herald Sun, and I just loved these stories. And when I did finally say to him, I think I want to be a journalist, he said, oh no. And I thought he'd be happy. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, oh no, the money's crap, the hours are worse. And I was stunned. I thought he'd be happy. And then he said, but it's the best seat in the house, kid.
Ah. That's right. That's true. That's very true. He worked on the back when it was the Herald, I suppose, back in those days in Melbourne.
The Sun Pictorial.
The Sun Pictorial, the Sun News Pictorial, as it was. Then what kind of a career did he have on that paper?
Well, he was 18, left Tasmania to go to the Herald Sun, and he told me I think he got £2 a week, and it was such a low wage, and Dad lived in a share house with blokes who ate baked beans and drank beer and chased girls, and his parents had to send him £1 a week just so he could survive in this terribly poor way. But he told stories about he was the paper's lead reporter for the Melbourne Olympics, and he loved telling the story about how he took a Russian shot putter out on a date, and it was front page, and a minder came with this woman who he said Dad looked more female than this woman did.
Was it true?
Yeah.
Oh, he did do this date?
Yes,
he did go on this date?
Yeah, so he told stories about the Olympics, and he told stories about going out with the cops, and back then, you know, you went to crime scenes and things
like
that.
Drank the coppers in the pub and afterwards too.
And the drinking, yes, well, that was big.
He had a connection to the legendary footy player and commentator Lou Richards. What was that connection?
Well, he used to tell, growing up, sometimes I thought, I reckon 10% of this might not be true. And so he used to tell a story about when he, because he loved sport and he was a very talented sportsman, and he loved playing football and he loved playing cricket and tennis, and he was a very good footballer, even though he was a little, he wasn't a big man. And Lou Richards, who was the captain of Collingwood at the time, they sort of experimented with a couple of ghostwriters for a column with Lou. And I think there were two and they didn't quite work out. And then they gave it to Dad, who I think back then was the young, smart-ass reporter.
Right. And how would they put the column together?
They go to the ghostwriter.
They go to the pub.
Lou's pub, right, which was right next door to the Herald Sun. And so...
Great days.
Dad
Great.
Used to say, oh, when Lou and I started, together they were gold. So the cheeky young reporter and the cheeky Collingwood football player, who they both had great turns of phrase, And Dad used to say, oh, they sold 100,000 extra copies, and because this column just went ballistic. And I'd go, yeah, Dad, yeah, it was probably 10,000 or 100. And then when they did a This Is Your Life for Lou, this fact came to being, and he came back from Melbourne and said, see, I told you it was true. But, yeah, he and Lou together were gold.
So he's got the dream life, eating baked beans and beer, going to the footy and writing a column with Lou Richards in the pub. Why the move to Tassie then?
Well, he met my mum Robin, and I think Dad had been a bit of a ladies' man. And Mum actually says that when she met Dad, she was like, oh, no, he's a bit sharp, a bit
right,
fast.
Bit of a lair?
Yeah, yep. And she said he looked like Steve McQueen. And I've looked at the photos, I'm thinking, oh, Mum, what were you on? I can't see it myself. So he was very handsome, according to Mum. And so they met each other, and he just fell instantly in love. So the ladies' man was well and truly off the market. And he said to me, it was years ago when he'd been diagnosed with cancer, and it couldn't be fixed, and we took a week off and we went to the beach, and I said, I've never got you and Mum. Like, you're Mr. Noisy, she's very quiet, you're a man of words, and I just don't understand. And he said, we've always been on the same page since day one. And I said, but why move to Tasmania? Your career was on fire. And he said, I looked around the newsroom, and he said, the toll that alcohol had wrought in the newsroom. He said, I did not want to risk this wonderful relationship. And he said, I decided if I didn't move, alcohol could destroy us. And he said, when you look around and see how many marriages have been ruined by alcohol, he said, so he went to Tasmania and became the editor of the paper there.
So he gave it away to become a family man in a way.
But, oh, that's what he said.
But that's lovely. That's a beautiful story. What did that mean, though, with him being an senior editor at The Examiner with his night shift and the family routine?
Well, we thought it was normal. And it's only, I suppose, years later I realised sort of what an unusual arrangement we had, because he would work night shift, and that meant that in the morning we all had to have breakfast, not in silence, but very close to, because he was still asleep. And Dad would sort of get up at about 9 and we'd all gone. So Mum had to manage three little kids who all want to be noisy in the morning. And then he'd come home for dinner at 5 to 7, listen to the regional news, and dinner was on the table at 7, and we watched the news and we all had to be quiet. And then at 7:30, he'd head back to the office. So it was a sort of odd... And then Saturday morning, there was this man in the house trying to boss us all around. And we're like, who are you?
Who are you?
And turn that jazz down, please. Because on Saturdays, Mum loves punting on the horses. And so she would say, they're yours, Michael. I don't care what happens to them today. I'm punting.
And Saturday was Mum's day off to go to the track.
Yeah, well, she'd put up with us all week, you know, the hell hour. I mean, I don't have kids, so the hell hour, Mum had to deal with that all on her own, Dad, because Dad wasn't there to help. And when he came home, he was still working while he ate. So all my friends used to know, you never call the Courtneys in the morning, because all those three kids have been trained to sleep in and be quiet. And on weekends, yeah, it was like, wow, Dad's here. Oh, yeah, I remember him from last Saturday.
So how did you fall in love with country life when you were a kid, Pip?
When I was 6, I was sent... My grandmother... my grandfather died when I was a little baby. And when I was... my grandmother remarried, and she remarried a farmer called Ken Bryant, who had a property in central Victoria. When I was 6, I was sent on this great adventure from Launceston. I was popped on the plane, and my Uncle Richard picked me up and took me out to Grandma's new farm. And it was love at first sight. I still remember when we got there late in the afternoon and the sun setting and there was a little pony in the paddock. I thought, this is the best place ever. And I have to come inside because it was getting dark and I just wanted to keep patting this pony. And I stayed with Grandma. Shearing was on, and I must have got in the way in the shearing shed. I thought I was being helpful with my little broom. And I love the shearers. I love the sheep. I love... My step-grandfather, Ken, showed sheep, and he was so proud of his sheep, so I'd tag along. Oh, I must have got under everyone's feet. I loved the chickens. I loved Grandma's agar. I loved what she cooked, and I just loved it, and I just couldn't understand why I had to go home at the end of it.
Oh, did you want to move there? Did you say that?
Well, I said to Mum and Dad, you've got one of each. You've got Beck, my sister, and you've got Nick, my brother. I thought I was excess to requirements, and I wanted to go and live with Grandma. I said, you've got to. You've got one of each. You don't need me, and I want to go and live with Grandma. And I was really lucky because they had a farm worker called George, and George and his wife Mary couldn't have children, and they adored children. And he loved me. So at 7 o'clock in the morning after breakfast, cooked on the Aga, eggs and bacon every morning, George would be at the front door waiting for me, and I just tagged around like a little puppy after him, and I'd sit up in the Land Cruiser with him. I'd go and help him feed the animals, and I just loved it, and I hated going home.
How did your dad sort of start training you, in a way, to become a journalist from such a young age?
Words were very important to him, and he got very cranky with the primary school that I was at, that we didn't seem to be learning grammar, and he went down and had words with the teachers, and they were like, Michael, they just need to know how to express themselves. Mm-hmm. And he thought this was lazy and sloppy. And Dad was he'd travelled to the US, he read widely, the New Yorker was his Bible, and so we grew up in a house where he would, I suppose it wasn't really until high school where you have to start learning how to write and you actually study English. And he would say, you've got to read the New Yorker to know what good writing is. And he wanted us to use words, to read well. And I was always looking at his big library, trying to read what he thought was important. And I think reading some of these books I tried very early on, and they were just beyond me. But the New Yorker with the movie reviews, that
Pauline Kael.
And he would say, look what she can do with 100 words, the right word. Look what this, some people could take 1,000 words and they still won't get across what Pauline can say about a movie. And he would say that this magazine, it's once a week, so our house was covered in, there were piles of New Yorkers everywhere. And we had great English teachers at school. And Dad just wanted us to fall in love with words and fall in love with reading.
So on the one hand, you've got this kind of tabloid populism from your dad's work, but then also this kind of this elegant form of writing in the form of the New Yorker. That's a pretty good mix to have, I would have thought.
Well, he was not snobby about the work that he'd done at the Herald Sun. And he said, tabloid's tough. We have to write tight. And he used to, it drove Mum mad when we were on holidays at the beach, because we'd be sitting there with newspapers comparing, The Age and The Australian and The Fin and The Examiner and The Mercury and The Advocate. They're all lying around, and I'm saying to Dad, well, what do you think about this layout? Because he was really good with layout as well. And he would sometimes say, so these big broadsheets, look how many paragraphs they've taken to tell the same story that the Herald Sun, he said, so don't you ever be snobby about tabloid. It's not a dirty word.
You went on to uni, but you didn't study journalism. Why
then,
not?
Dad had a mate, Geoffrey Barker from The Fin, who came for a weekend, and over a few red wines, the two of them planned my career, or planned my study to give me a career. And I said, what about journalism schools? And back then, I mean, I'm an old duck, so back in, 1982, journalism schools were really pretty rare, and Dad didn't think much of them. He's a man of very strong opinions.
Yeah.
And he and Jeff, over God knows how many red wines, they said, all right, we'll go and study arts, and you'll be studying arts with a purpose. And they said, study English so you know what great writing is. Study philosophy so you know the great questions man has been asking since man could write. You've got to know those because you're young, and that's what's going to impede you when you start, because you know nothing of life. And then study history. There's nothing worse, Dad said, than having an 18-year-old reporter asking Neville Wran a question about politics. If you don't know about the politics of the past and the history of the past, and what was the other one? Studying politics, because Michelle Grattan was my idol. And I still remember when I was at college and I had a picture of Michelle Grattan up on my board. And during uni holidays, our rooms were rented out to other people coming down for conferences, and someone had left me a note and said, I didn't expect to come to a uni student's little hovel and find pictures of Michelle Grattan. And Dad talked about Michelle Grattan a lot during the dams dispute when, he would say she would ring at the last minute very late at night to check a fact. He said she just does not leave anything to chance. And so the way he spoke about her, how much he admired her, I thought, I want to be her when I grow up.
So at an age when most girls would have a pin-up of Adam and the Ants, you had Michelle Grattan. Okay. You joined the ABC News team in Hobart, and you almost chucked it in. Why?
Well, yes, I was very lucky. I got a cadetship that a couple of hundred people back then would have applied for. Then I became a radio news cadet, and I think I would probably have been the worst cadet the ABC News has ever had. I just didn't get it. I'd come from 3 years at uni writing long essays, and I suppose looking back now, I actually didn't understand the nuts and bolts of what Dad did. I was always in the office, you know, when Dad would take us on Saturdays, because when Mum, you know, said, I don't want to see these children for 7 hours, they're yours, Michael, he'd go to work. So I loved the newsroom. Back then, you know, there were women in the newsroom in their beehive hairdos and their flares, walking around laughing and joking. And I loved sitting next to the photo machine where all the photos from around the world would be spat out, and I'd collect all the ones with the horses or the queen and take them home and put them in scrapbooks. So I always thought my life would be in newspapers. But I never really asked Dad about how you do journalism. I just not knew I wanted to do it. And then I'm in a newsroom and I was hopeless. I didn't understand what... I'd go to a press conference and come back and they'd say, what's the lead? And I'd go, oh, it's all interesting. 30 minutes of interesting. And I've got to file a 45-second story. And I go, what do you mean? So it took me... Well, I didn't get it for 18 months. I was hopeless.
How did you learn? Who taught you?
So there was a lovely old fellow, Ian, in the newsroom who knew Dad. And he took me aside one day. He could see I was drowning. I was hopeless. And he said, I'm going to be your Southern Dad. Okay, so next time you go to a press conference, you come back and see me. I'm not going to tell you what question I'm going to ask you. So I came back bewildered by yet another fascinating press conference where it was all interesting. News 24 would have been perfect for me back then. I would have said, just roll on the whole lot. It's all interesting. And I said, okay, Ian, I'm back. And he said, what was it about? And I'd say, oh, $200 million for a new road. That's your lead, kid. What's the next most interesting thing that happened today? And I'd say, he said, that's your second par and your third par. And I started to get it, but I still felt like I was letting Dad down, that I was still hopeless. And if I wasn't in the office, everyone must have been sitting back going, well, the Courtney journalism genius clearly didn't get passed down the line. So I rang Dad one day and said, I'm out. I'm done. I was very teary and said, I've embarrassed you and I'm embarrassing myself. I'm going to go to Geelong and study wall classing. And he said, whoa, hang on. I'll send you a book. Don't make any decisions till you've read it. And so he sent me a book called News Sense, written by an Adelaide journalist. And I got it. Light bulb went off. And I thought, now I know what I'm doing.
You said you were always fascinated by horses and ponies. When were you able to afford to buy your own horse, Pip?
Well, Dad being the very opinionated man he was, I pestered for a pony. He'd say, if you get 50% in French, you can have a pony. I get 50%.
50%?
I got a tennis racket. and I borrowed a one-eyed pacer from somebody. If somebody had a horse no one else wanted, I would somehow find a way of getting it. But he would not buy me a pony. I didn't have the money. And so my first pay packet, I paid a dollar for an old racehorse that was in a paddock near where we lived who was starving to death, and I bought him, and he had two blown front tendons. Why I did that, I don't know, but I had no money. I was a cadet journalist at the ABC, and so I bought a ute, and Dad is just rolling his eyes because Dad was big on five-year plans and he was big on saving money, and I just bought a horse that was going to keep me broke. And so I bought Ned, who'd, like most people ride, I suppose, race horses that have failed on the track. Ned was a superstar, and I think he'd won something like 19 from 21 races.
Oh, wow.
He was a very fast horse, but I just bought this bag of bones and started feeding him and looking after him, and I was in heaven. I had my own horse. And I was riding him down in Hobart through the bush, and I just couldn't believe how lucky I was to have this poor old animal. It took me a year before he was okay again. But, yeah, I just couldn't believe how lucky I was.
What was the best experience you ever had on a horse?
A friend of mine, Kathy Yule, rang me one day and she said, let's go to Seven Mile Beach. So if you fly into Hobart, that beautiful beach near the airport is Seven Mile Beach, and they even have car parks there for horse floats. So it was a beautiful sunny day. She had a horse that was off the track, but he was off the track because he was as slow as a wet week. So I'd never really opened up Ned. I'd never really said, let's go 100%, because you're bombing around in the bush. And I think it was the perfect summer day. He was finally healthy again. And Kathy and I said, right, let's see what these old fellas have got. And it was like being on in a Ferrari. We went gallop side by side for a little while. And then I just said to her, looked over, and she said, let him go. Let's see what he can do. And I let him go. And I mean, he was about 16.2 hands, so he's quite a big horse, and I'm just touch under 5.3. So I just opened him up, and I just was like finding another gear, and then a little bit more and a little bit more. And I don't think I'll ever forget what it was like to be on top of a horse that I now had. I couldn't have stopped him if I tried. He was going flat strap, and you can't hear anything except his breath. And it's like a train, and I'm sitting there like a little pimple on top of this massive power horse of muscle. And if he'd stopped at a piece of seaweed on the beach, I was toast. And it was the most exhilarating moment of my life, going flat out. There's no end. The beach just goes and goes. And it was absolutely exhilarating. And I suppose jockeys get to experience that every day, every week, and I just got it for that little probably 15 minutes of just maybe probably not that long. I can't even remember how long it, but I went until he just ran out of puff.
Do you think the horse is exhilarated as you are to do that?
I think they're built to go fast, thoroughbreds. I mean, they're pretty stupid. they're not the cleverest animal, but they know how to go fast. And I'd seen some of his old race videos. And he was pretty, he was a horse with his own mind, didn't like other animals getting in front of him. And I think he really enjoyed it. And I was terrified and exhilarated at the same time. And I didn't know how it was going to end.
And how did it end? How could you stop him once he was going?
I tried to pull him up at one point because I looked back and Kathy, I couldn't even see her. And then I started to feel like, well, let's just let him decide when he wants to stop. And we pulled up and went back to Kathy, and she just was like, wow, how was that? And I said, oh, I just want to come back and do that again.
You and John Bean were married for 12 years. How did you meet John, Pip?
Well, I, like a lot of Tasmanians, I wanted to get over the water. I wanted to get out of Tassie, not because I didn't love it, but there's this feeling when you grow up in Tassie that you need to go and prove yourself on the mainland, and Dad had proved himself in Melbourne, and I wanted to do that. And so I applied for this job at Landline, and I thought it ties in perfectly. I studied ag science in grade 12 and absolutely loved it. And I couldn't study it at uni because I'm a science moron, basically. And so this seemed to me to be the perfect job for me, agriculture and journalism. And so I rock up in Canberra, never having done long-form journalism before. And I've been a court reporter for 5 years, which is not the sort of journalism where you have to concentrate on beautiful pictures. It's exteriors of court buildings and people walking in and out. And John was my cameraman for my first shoot, which I didn't organise very well at all because I didn't know how to do it properly. And he very kindly took me aside at the end of the shoot and said, maybe the next shoot you might want to plan it a bit better. And I said, oh, what do you mean? And so he really helped me. He could have let me struggle. And and I just love working with him. It was a whole new world doing long form where pictures are really important, and getting sequences and finding out who the talent is through pictures.
So it was a warm friendship then that evolved into love, or was it more like love at first sight?
It was love at first sight for me. I came back and told my friend Brenda Conroy I'd met the nicest man in the world, and she rolled her eyes and said, every woman in the building, it's a pretty big building, Canberra Parliament House, loves John. And he was with had a girlfriend at the time, and everyone thought that they would get married. And I said, oh, yeah, I understand that. I'll just look from afar. And John went overseas and came back about 6 months later, and Murray McLaughlin rang me and said, right, Courtney, all the best cameramen come out of Tasmania. Can you recommend one? We've got it. And I was in Melbourne at this time. I'd moved to Melbourne for Landline, and Murray ran 7:30 in Melbourne, and he said, we need a cameraman. Who can you recommend? And I knew that John wanted to move from Canberra, and I said, oh, maybe you don't want to look south for a cameraman. Maybe you want to look north to Canberra. John Bean, I reckon he's the go, and he wants to move. And I get a phone call from John a few weeks later. Guess what? I'm moving to Melbourne. I'm like, really? Fancy that. Do you need somewhere to stay?
You sly devil, you.
So he was my flatmate for a little while. Yeah.
That will do the trick.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Tell me why you were a little bit worried when John proposed to you.
Well, yeah, so we moved in, and I couldn't believe that I was going out with this man that Brenda Conroy had said, don't even think about that. I did ring her and after he did propose and say, Brenny, guess what? But yes, he proposed. I'd cooked a lamb curry. I always said that was the magic lamb curry. And I always knew I didn't want to have children. So I thought, oh dear, he wants to get married and he loves kids. And the my little dream is over. I'm going to have to say I don't want to have children. And I don't think I'm the right person to have children. And I thought he's going to have to say, well, I'm going to have to move on. And he didn't. He said, well, I gave him 24 hours. When he said it didn't matter, I said, well, how about you think about it for 24 hours? Because it does matter. And I don't want to hold you back from your dreams. So anyway, he said, I don't need 24 hours. Let's get married and we'll be the best auntie and uncle. Our nieces and nephews who aren't here yet will be, and we'll be the best godparents to our friends' children. And we'll be those fun people.
How relieved were you when he said that?
I still said, you know, you've got 24 hours, how about 48, and don't buy a ring yet because you might want to take it back. And he didn't change his mind.
You lost your dad in 1998, and that was particularly devastating for you because you were in touch with him all the time, weren't you, right throughout your adult years?
Yeah. I never cared how busy he was. I was always on the phone. And loved, you know, I used to go home summer holidays and spend a lot of time with mum and dad. I wasn't much of a traveller. I just wanted to spend time with horses and dad. And when mum rang to say that, you know, the skin cancer is going to take him, I couldn't believe it. And it was just too soon. He was a fitness fanatic, went to the gym every day. And he was so diligent with his sunscreen and, yeah, that his time growing up as a little boy in Tonga and the Pacific Islands with his dad, who was a doctor, it came back to bite him, you know, many years later. And I don't know how I would have survived that without John by my side. And, yeah, Dad was given 3 months, and just moved in with John, and I rang my boss, Kerry Lonigan, and said, I've got to quit, I'm going home to Tassie. And Kerry was great. He said, no, you can't leave. And I said, oh, what am I going to do? Work out of the Launceston office for Landline? He went, yep, let's do that. So that was great. I got to go back and be with mum and mum, you know, who nursed dad through his illness. And so I got to be at home. So that was great. And then John, he was just my rock. You know, my world had fallen apart. And yeah. And mum said, this guy is a keeper. Look how he's dealing with this crazy family at this awful time. And John proposed when dad was sick. And he went in and asked Dad for me, my hand. And Dad said, John, you can't afford her. I said, I know that, Mr. Courtney. And, yeah, so to get married and not have Dad walk me down the aisle was just a very difficult day.
You and John had this lovely shack in Tasmania. Paint a picture of it for me.
Well, The year that, with the 2011 floods, we decided we were going to get away from all the rain and go down to Tassie for a week, and it rained. Tasmania was flooding too. And we went and stayed where I'd always had my childhood summers, 2 weeks every year at Mum's aunt and uncle's shack at Hawley Beach, which is my favourite, apart from Grandma's farm, my favourite place in the world. And so it was raining, and John was on the internet looking at shacks, and we both love mid-century modern architecture. And John found this mid-century modern fibro shack and at Hawley, just around the corner from Mum's aunt and uncle's place. And we went and had a look at it, and we walked in, and we just both looked at each other. It was really run down. We just fell in love with it. And he said, "Let's buy it." I said, "That's crazy. We've still got a mortgage in Brisbane." And he said, "Come on, let's do it. It's your favourite place. We can retire here. Let's grab a bit of real estate while we can, and it'll be there in 20 years' time when we retire." And so we bought it, and it's got tenants, and we had to put tenants in it to try and afford it, but that was our dream. And I couldn't believe that he'd buy into my dream, because they were my summer holidays, and he's a Queensland boy. Why he'd want a piece of Tasmanian beach, I don't know, but he agreed with me. It's one of the most beautiful places in Tasmania.
And we come to the hard part. In August 2011, he and John and the reporter Paul Lockyer and the pilot Gary Ticehurst were in a helicopter doing a story for the ABC near Lake Eyre. How did you get the news that the ABC helicopter had been lost near Lake Eyre?
I was at work. It was about after 9 o'clock at night, and it was a Thursday night, I think. And I was writing a script for the show for that weekend on the Ekka, and Kate Tawney rang me and said, "The helicopter's gone missing." I didn't really take much notice of what she said. I look back on that now and I can't quite comprehend why I didn't react the way I should have reacted, but I just thought, that's crazy. Everyone's got confused, and I just assumed Kate would call me back later and say it's all a big mistake, so I kept writing my script.
And then when it was confirmed that John was on board and it had crashed?
Well, I kept writing my script, and then when Pete Lewis and Bernie Bowen came into the office, and the looks on their faces, and I thought, they know more than me. And so I just said to Pete, "Right, sub my script, I'll put my voice down. If this is true, you're going to have a 10-minute black hole in your show tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday, that's when the show gets put to bed." And he was like, "No, you got to go home now." And I said, "We know nothing." I think he was a bit surprised. Anyway, we'll put my voice down. I said, "If it is true, at least when you get in the morning, it can be cut and you don't have a big black hole. And if it is true, it's going to be messy tomorrow." So I went home and looked online obsessively, and The Australian had it up on their website, and I'd been given a number to call, and it was engaged, and we just sort of waited and waited and waited, and I said to my friend Carolyn, who was with me, I said, "I'm not believing it until a policeman knocks on the door. It's wrong. It's just not true. I don't care what's on The Australian. I don't care what's on radio. It's not true." And then a man knocked on my door, and he was wearing a police uniform, and I just said, no, you can't come in, and you've got to go." And he said, "I have to come in." And I said, no, please just go." And, yeah, so it was true.
Sully Sarah came rushing to your aid at that point.
Yeah, well, she rang me as I got home, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And I'm like, "Sully, nothing's true yet. It's not true." And, again, there was part of my brain that thought, Sally's ringing from Afghanistan, there's something in this, so... And, Sally turned up. Lisa Miller came from America. And Sal stayed with me for 3 or 4 weeks. And tell you what, when shit hits the fan, there's no better person to have by your side than the very, very steady and very funny Sally Sarah, who made us laugh when we needed to laugh, and that you can even laugh when... in the weeks that followed. But, yeah, she was there at every bad moment when I needed somebody.
You have to, of course, interact with the authorities, the police, the coroners, and all of that, and you have to give them information. Tell me what the coroner's assistant told you, and I think you better say his exact words. It's blunt as they are.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had police in the house wanting, collecting DNA and doing, you know, having to describe every, you know, what John looked like and filling out forms. And this lovely man who comes, he was a psychologist, and he was there when the coroner's staff came to collect DNA. And I noticed he was observing me. I mean, I was sort of valiumed up a little, a lot, I guess. But I still noticed him looking at me but not saying anything. And people were coming and going, and the house was so busy for weeks. And it's not a very big house, and it was just always full of people. And then everyone seemed to disappear all of a sudden, and I was just left with him. And he said, oh, I need to talk to you. And I said, okay. He said, you strike me as a fairly no-bullshit sort of girl. I went, oh, I suppose that's one way of describing me. And he said, you're not religious, are you? And I said, no. And he said, I need to talk to you about what's coming down the pipe. And I said, okay. And he said, and yes, you've given me permission to swear on the show. So he said, you're going to be fucked. And I was like, what? He said, you and John had a great relationship, number one. Number two, you don't have children. Number three, you worked with each other. And number four, which is critical, is you will never see his body. And he said, that is a recipe for some really serious problems, and you need to get help, and you need to get it now, and you need to listen to what people, what whoever helps you says. And I was just quite stunned at what he'd said, because I'm looking at him thinking, it's all a big mistake, and you're all here, you're wasting your time, he's coming home. So I thought, I just nodded and went, yeah. I thought all these people are going to be proved so wrong when he comes home. I think I was quite bonkers at the time.
I don't know, it's a very large serving of grief to have put in front of you. You can't all eat it all at once, can you? Is that it? Or what was it, do you think, that meant you just couldn't accept the fact of his death?
Well, because I'd spoken to him 2 days before. I'd seen the news with the pictures from the air of the three blue body bags, and but I couldn't process it. And I don't know how many times I looked at the story. For a long time, I couldn't listen to the ABC News music because I'd watched this story so many times hoping for a different ending. But I couldn't process the information.
How long did it take for you to accept that he wasn't going to come home?
Well, I always remember when my father died that the man who did the service at the church said, people go into shock for a reason. It's so you can get things done. You can organise funerals. You can do what needs to be done. And he said it lasts a week. So I'd always had that in the back of my mind. But when the counsellor said it can last, if you don't see a body, that is actually part of the process where you will you actually have to accept what's happened. And she said, for the people I see, they can be in shock for up to 3 years. And I think I was in shock. I was in denial, and it didn't matter. Even at John's memorial service, I was looking at my little brother Nick going, you're in John's spot. Where's John going to sit? And where's Nick going to sit when John asked Nick to move? So part of me was thinking that whole, it was out-of-body experience, I think. And as a police reporter, I remember a case where a young man had murdered the man who'd sexually abused him for years and years, describing what it was like to murder this man, and he was on the other side of the room watching someone like him murder this man. And that came back to me a lot, that I seemed to be observing the life of someone called Pip Courtney, but this couldn't possibly be mine. And you're looking at it through very thick glass, and somehow the information that you need to process will not come through the glass, but at another level you know what's going on. So denial is a big thing, I guess, and shock.
Must be a kind of survival mechanism of a kind.
I think so, and that the counsellor said if you do absorb all the information at once, you can't really survive it. And I, every now and then I would get a moment of clarity, and it was like being, I liken it to a fall I had on a horse where he rolled on me. And I stood up and I afterwards, but it was, the moment of impact is you're alive, but you feel that the stuffing has been knocked out of you, and you, for a half a second you don't know whether that's your last breath or not. And that's, it would be like a gut punch where the information would somehow worm its way into your brain for about 2 seconds, and then you can feel your body and your brain fight against it, and then it's gone. That moment of clarity is gone.
So there was this huge public memorial service held for John and the others at the convention centre. A huge number of people were there, and you gave this very long and moving eulogy. What got you through that, Pip?
Well, the plan was, I wrote a eulogy, and as I was writing it, again, I felt like I was someone who looked like me and lived in a house like ours, writing about people like us. And then other parts of me knew that this was my last opportunity to tell people what John meant to not just me, but to everybody, and to pull his life into some sort of perspective and show the people who only knew him at work what he was like as a husband and as an uncle, and to his family what people at work thought of him and his talents, and to remind people that he wasn't just a great cameraman, he was just the most wonderful human being.
The nicest guy in the building.
Yeah, and I felt like Dad was there going, you better get this right. Mm. I better have taught you well about the right word and the right sequence of words, and if you bugger this up, I thought he's going to bloody well come down from wherever he is and say, that's not right, didn't I teach you anything? And the plan was, I thought, I can't possibly stand up and read this, so Sally Sara was going to read it. So I'd make an attempt, but I didn't even know if I'd get up the stairs. And Lisa Miller, the darling Lisa, she said, what will get you through when you start falling apart is if you can have something in your hand or your pocket or with you that means nothing. Not John's wedding ring, not something that John gave you, but something random. So we're in the house and she said, what's random? What doesn't mean anything to you? And I said, oh, for some reason I picked this little china blue and white bird that you rest chopsticks on. And so it would fit in your hand. She said, right, grab that. Whenever you're about to lose it, just say to yourself, in my hand is a blue and white china bird, and you put chopsticks on it. And it's got lots of other little birds that are its friends in the drawer. And she said, just, you know, stop your brain, a circuit breaker. And about halfway through the speech, I just thought, I can't do this anymore. Sally was up there with me. And then I thought, if this is worse than what John went through, you can go and sit down. And I thought, you will finish this, because this is not worse than what John got through, and Dad is going to come down and kick your ass if you don't keep going, and you do this because you're going to do it for John, and Sally can just sit there, but you will finish it. And I finished it.
What's the impact of that huge wave of public sympathy that followed? 1,500 cards and letters that came to you, Pip?
It was extraordinary. I didn't move from a piece of carpet for about 2 hours as people from all walks of life came, people that knew John and people that didn't.
In all honesty, was it meaningful? Because yes. These are people who think they know you, but you don't know them, really, in all honesty. Was it meaningful for you nonetheless to get those cards and letters?
Oh, yes. And it is something I do say to people now is, when in doubt, send the casserole. When in doubt, send the card. When in doubt, send the text. When in doubt, go to the funeral to look up and see how many people were there that John meant something to them. No matter if it was a school friend or someone he'd filmed on another story, not just Landline. It means so much. And I think a lot of people, they think when a family tragedy happens, oh, I won't get in the way. I won't make the call. They'll be too busy to answer it. They'll have their closest and nearest and dearest. And what I learned through that is every little act of kindness, of remembrance, means something. So it didn't matter that I didn't know some of the people there. What I got from that is, look at all these people who came, who flew from all around the country, who came from overseas, what that means to the family and the people left behind is it's immeasurable. And yes, there might be your family and your friends who do many, many, many things, but there are some people out there who will never know that that text that came at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday when you've just had a horrible, lonely weekend. And it might have been the only thing that they've sent, but it just gets you out of a hole. It keeps you going. It's like a brick wall. And I think, you know, your family and your friends might put in 50 bricks, but other people put in one or two. And every brick adds to, I suppose, the total feeling. And like, I couldn't have fallen over if I'd wanted to, really. I never had a chance where I could slip through. There was always somebody there caring.
Two objects of John's were miraculously found and returned to you, his wedding ring and a card from his digital camera. Did they bring you any kind of comfort, Pip?
No. The digital card, seeing the photos that he'd taken, he bought a camera. He wanted to take great photos for Paul Lockyer's book on Lake Eyre. And when he said he wanted to spend all this money on a camera, I was aghast. I'm like, oh, God, that's two saddles for a horse I don't have. But, you know, he was such a great photographer as well as a cinematographer, and he wanted to take great photos that would be in a book. And so he practiced on me when I was cooking in the kitchen for a MasterChef party that we were having. And to see those moments where we're having so much fun in the kitchen, and I'd buggered up this bomb Alaska. He always used to tease me about how I was dyslexic about shapes, and so I'd cut up the sponge cake into the shapes, and he looked at it and he burst out laughing. He said, "You are," he said, "you can't read maps, you can't read sewing patterns, and you've done everything the wrong way." So he actually had to sort of cut all my sponge cake up again. So it was a very funny moment where he said, "I just can't believe how hopeless you are at some things and you're so competent at others." So, and then photos of the trip. And so, no, they weren't comforting at all. But to get the wedding ring back, it's my most prized possession, apart from our two pussycats.
Australians aren't very good at grief, by and large, and I suspect country Australians are even worse at it. You're that least said, soonest mended thing that goes on, stiff upper lip and all that. You speak out about this now, about grief. What do you really want people in that situation to understand?
Well, I needed help to manage it, and I only went along and saw the counsellor so I could walk out at the end of the hour and say, "See, it doesn't help. She can't fix me. She can't make it go away." But it was very valuable. And so to people stuck in grief, I would say get some help, because they can't fix it, but they can at least let... I'd go in and say to her, "I'm the maddest, craziest person in Brisbane, probably Australia." And she would just say, "Where you are is where I would expect someone like you to be. What you're experiencing is normal." And I thought, well, I'm a journalist. I've read the book on grief. I've read about the stages, and I'm not going through the stages like in the book. And she was so, the advice is so valuable. It's like, it's not like going through grade 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. You graduate and then you move neatly onto the next stage. You can experience three of them at once. You can go through one and then come back and revisit it 3 months later, that it is a roller coaster. And you can hear some music on the radio that'll just drag you back, and you think you're halfway up a hill, and then next you're back in the valley of, you know, bewilderment and tears again. And so I think, well, my counsellor used to say, Australians are so bad at grief. Other cultures do it well. They have rituals that allow you to feel supported and that you can talk about it. And Australians, she says, are the worst. And, yeah, I've learned, unfortunately, learned a lot about it.
Since then, you've become a presenter of Landline. And I don't know, it seems like there's a kind of a really interesting intimacy between you and your audience now, and a kind of familiarity. People sort of go, "Oh, there's Pip," you know. It's a bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of them feel like that I know them and they know me, and I love that they feel connected to the program and me in that way.
You're as familiar as a gumboot by the back door, aren't you?
Yeah, I know. I'm getting older as they watch. Yeah. Well, I've been on the show for so long anyway. I think they might not have known me, because I tend to not want to be in my stories. I like the pictures that the camera crews have shot to be the focus of the stories, and I like to stay out of it. So to be... front and centre, hosting was a really uncomfortable place for me to be. But
someone's got to do it.
Someone has to do it. But I took the job because I thought it would be scary and I need something to scare me because work is how I keep going. Deadlines are, you can't say, oh, Landline's going to go to wear at 4 o'clock this Sunday afternoon because Pip couldn't get her act together because, she's had a bit of a weep in the toilets this morning. Deadlines are, that's what they're about. And I thought they're going to keep me going. And hosting and doing something that's going to scare me every week will keep me going.
And just very briefly at the end, in the moments we've got left, what do you know about people now you didn't know before the accident?
The level of kindness out there is something I had never understood or never fully appreciated. And I think that's what I know. People are so kind and so supportive, whether it's some big old farmer when we get out of the car or come over and give me a big hug and whisper in my ear, we're all with you, kid. Or the lovely Italian mama up in Stanthorpe who rushed out of her house when we turned up for a shoot just after the accident. She was covered in flour. She's making gnocchi. And we'd filmed up there with John before, and she just gave me a big flowery hug and said, we miss him too. The farmers who baked for me wrote letters. My friends, it's taken me a long time, and I'm pretty tedious. I fall into my little black holes, and they're just always there. They don't give up on you.
Pip, thanks so much for coming on the program and talking about it all. I want to bring you back on at some point to talk about people in the country that you've reported on, but for the moment anyway, it's been lovely to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to Pip Courtney late last year. I'm going to be away for the next week and a bit, leaving you with the wonderful Sarah Kanofsky. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.